Broadcasting from the Hip Hop Weekly Studios, I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Civic Cypher, where our mission is to foster allyship, empathy, and understanding. I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward. You are listening to Civic Cypher.
Indeed you are. And today we have a very special guest with us. She goes by the name of Siobhan Arline Bradley. Welcome to the show.
Hello, my friends. It's good to see you and be with you today.
Oh, yes. And this is not our first time. We've had a fantastic conversation in the past on the Black Information Network, and we felt that it would be meaningful and timely to have you on this show as well. For those that don't know, Siobhan Arline Bradley is the president of the National Council of Negro Women. And this is a very significant organization. Allow me to read a little bit of your bio just so our listeners will know a bit about the type of conversation we're about to have today. So, Black women are one of the strongest voting blocks in the United States. We know statistically more than two-thirds of Black women turned out to vote in the 2020 presidential election, the third highest rate of any race gender group. The National Council of Negro Women seeks to be the convener of our collective agency to make sure the power of the vote is utilized not only to elect Black women to office, but also to cast votes for those against anti-racism work and policy outreach. While a part of the Legacy 8 civil rights organizations, for 88 years, NCNW has been in the fight for civil rights, often with the only woman at the table being the late Dr. Dorothy Height. In its 88th year, the NCNW has changed its structure, as well as added a new pay position, the president and CEO, to meet the needs of the 21st century. The most significant change is that the new president and CEO, Siobhan Arline Bradley, is for the first time under the age of 50 at 45, and we are excited to have our conversation today. But first, like we always do at this time, we're going to start the show off with some Ebony Excellence.
Shall we?
I think we shall. So, today's Ebony Excellence is sponsored by Major Threads. For innovative, fashionable sportswear, check majorthreads.com. And today we're going to shout out Beyonce. She is an example of Ebony Excellence quite a bit on this show, and we're not mad at that one bit. So, today we're going to read a bit from Unbranded Entertainment. Beyonce has made history with her album Cowboy Carter, as she's now the first Black woman to ever hit number one on the Billboard's Top Country Albums chart. This comes just over a month after Beyonce's Texas Hold'em made her the first Black woman with a number one country single. Cowboy Carter debuted as the number one album, making it her eighth to the top of the Billboard 200 chart. Beyonce knocked Morgan Wallen's album One Thing at a Time off the top spot of the chart. Cowboy Carter has more than 300 million streams in the U.S. alone and is estimated to be the biggest album release of 2024. This is the pop star's biggest album release since 2016's Lemonade, which debuted with sales of more than 650,000 units at the time. Cowboy Carter features country music legend Dolly Parton, as well as collaborations with artists such as Miley Cyrus and Post Malone.
Willie Nelson makes an appearance a couple times too.
Listen, man, you know more than me. I'm not mad at you. But
I'm not mad at her either.
There you go, right? Right. So one of the things that one of the reasons that we chose to highlight Beyonce for this week's Ebony Excellence is because when the single Texas Hold'em first dropped, we had to talk about that, right? And we had to talk about the pushback from people that don't like to see change. There you go. People that
you're saying that so gracefully.
Yeah.
It's so good.
And now that she is number one with not only the single but with the album, we all have to salute her and we all have to respect the numbers. So shout out to Beyonce. All right. So now the guest of honor is with us. So Siobhan Arline Bradley, do us a favor. Now, we talked a little bit about you, and I do want to talk more about you. But before we get started, talk to us a bit about the National Council of Negro Women.
Yeah. First of all, thank you all for having me. It's really good to be in a space of information and connection. NCNW was founded on December the 5th, 1935. Mm-hmm. I think people don't really understand the context of what it means to be a Black woman in 1935, meeting in New York City where it was legal to gather. And she, Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune, was our founder, the first Black woman to ever found a college. which is Bethune-Cookman University, Bethune-Cookman College at that time. And she brought together women from various organizations, about 22 Black women's national organizations. So a few of the Divine Nine members, faith leaders, business women, women who were connected around Black issues. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about NCNW is 89 years later, almost 70% of that list is still on our list today. Mm. Right? Because 1935 was the middle of the Depression. It was the middle of, you know, post the women's suffrage march movement being done, but not for Black women, right? Black women weren't in the suffrage context. We were in the movement, but we were not beneficiaries of the movement. And Bethune was one of the leaders of those women clubs, of that kind of movement and engagement. So NCNW has expanded over 350 sections or chapters across the country. And our coin phrase is, we're an organization of organizations, which means that 36 national Black women's organizations and their membership allows us to reach over 2 million women and their families across this country. And we're engaging on empowering, advocating, and leading women of African descent, their families, and communities. That is our mission. And we've been able to engage it through policy and advocacy, programs and service, but also overall mobilization. And our ability to engage economics, healthcare, education, and social justice. It has been our lot. We'll be celebrating 90 years next year.
Wow, that is incredible to hear. And how important it was 90 years ago. We got to talk about how important it is today when you see organizations like the Fearless Fund coming under attack from policymakers and lawmakers because right. they focus on helping Black women succeed with the attacks and policy on DEI and CRT. Talk to us a little bit about why the organization is so important today and the regression that you've seen from, again, our lawmakers and policymakers with regards to women of color and their progress.
You know, this is one of my favorite conversations because full disclosure, I come from a Black context. And because I do, I always help people understand that DEI for Black women is very personal. Mm. Because in many cases and spaces, Black women are holding the bag for DEI in institutions and corporations and foundations. Fearless Fund is a great example. We actually filed an amicus brief, which is a brief in the courts to support the Sisters of the Fearless Fund. I am a member of Delta Sigma Theta. That's my soror. We are one of the national partnership leaders in this work. And NCNW, with other sororities, other Black women leaders, supported us in advancing this amicus brief. Why? Because in the courts, we're saying that we're not going to stand for you coming for an investment in Black women or women in general who have a vested interest in implementing and identifying capital to advance Black women's business. That's the first thing. I think the second thing with this DEI fight, I've been saying this all along, Black women have been the sacrificial lambs of this DEI fight across the country.
What do you mean? You see
terms like, let me say what I mean by that. CRT, it's critical race theory. It is a term that has been hijacked and completely misdefined because it is a legal theory that was taught in law schools. You think about the Bells of the world, those leaders that started that context and that theory. I think about my sister, Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, who coined that phrase intersectionality. She and her group have been able to track over 619 pieces of legislation or referendums in the local school boards to remove Black history and ban books. And they called it a CRT movement. If you're watching the process, that is not what CRT is. CRT is really a theory that says that racial context has been embedded in systems in this country. That is not a theory that's taught in elementary school. That's not taught at the high school level. So what NCNW is saying, well, no, what we're going to do is take a coordinated strategic plan on identifying those states, those companies, those corporations that are not advancing DEI, not only call that out, but speak to how we strategically redefine this issue. Because what those folks that are suing for affirmative action, that are suing in these courts, what they have done is set this up in courts across this country. This is not a new thing, right? This is a coordinated plan to remove DEI from the fabric of our country, when in actuality, the country was actually supposed to be founded on diversity and inclusion. Mm-hmm. The problem they have is the equity.
Mm-hmm. You know what's funny about that? Is that, first off, that's one thing that I say quite a bit when I encounter challenges on, you know, DEI initiatives. is that, you know what, without the diversity and without the inclusion, if we just stood on equity, eventually we would get to the same finish line. And so if you want to rename it equity, and if you have a problem with equity, then, you know, we're having a different conversation. So I appreciate you saying that. Another thing I want to say is that on this show, we often push back against the rebranding of critical race theory, CRT, because we often will say, when talking about CRT as it is branded by conservatives, by the right, we call it CRT, or what it should be referred to as, which is American history. And so we always add that additional element so that people don't forget that we're indeed talking about real American history and not some boogeyman term CRT. So I do appreciate and respect the fact that there is this effort to not lose the narrative and not let them chronicle the narrative without challenging it. So, you know, my hat's off to you for that, because I think that a lot of people need to know it, and you've perhaps defined it better than we ever have on the show.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think one thing that is a nuance for many people is that DEI also exposes structures and systems that have historically been favoring a racial class, a racial context. See, this idea of race is really hard for people because we've grown up in it all of our lives. But in actuality, race is a social construct that was created by our government, our country, to put value and place value and put power and money into space. And I don't think we have those conversations often. So I'm deemed a woman and a Black woman. So that has a different, you know, definition and context inside this racial construct. Because this is a gender conversation, it's a race conversation. So it's all connected historically. And you know what's interesting? I find that brothers and sisters from other countries, they experience this very differently. And I always like to tell this story about American race experiences because it is nuanced to our country.
We are now living in the wake of the results of our former president's election and the things that happened while he was in office, the decisions that were made, most notably the Supreme Court. Here we are again, and it looks like he's going to be on the ballot again. With Black women being such a powerhouse in these election cycles and showing up, you know, to cast their votes, and us seeing a very, very intentional and aggressive voter suppression initiative from the other side. Speak a little bit to the way that you guys can help, or that we can all help combat that.
Yeah. So, you know how in school, when you get over 90%, you get an A. I'm giving Black women an A, right, for engaging, because we have been consistently over 90% in our voter turnout numbers across this country. NCNW is creating an 8-state all-state strategy. Yeah. The 8-state all-state strategy is honing in on those states that have the highest percentage of what we call low propensity Black voters and high percentage of Black populations in pockets in those states. A low propensity voter is a voter that may or may not vote in an election. Yeah. Right. So we're trying to tap into not the listener that already knows social justice, not the listener that has voted in every election. We're trying to talk to the sister, the brother, the person who's saying, you know what? I don't even know if elections are anything, you know, that I want to get involved in. Well, the 8-state strategy says these states: Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Ohio, Michigan, Virginia, Pennsylvania. You think about those states I've named. They have these massive Black pockets of urban and suburban and rural spaces where Black people not only are populating, but also where we find challenges with low propensity voters. I will tell you another focus that we have at NCNW. 17 and 18 year olds in this country. We are in those 8 states and all states asking our partners to identify partnerships with high schools across the United States. Focus on 17 year olds that are going to be 18 by this election, as well as college freshmen who in many cases don't get registered until they go to school. Why, Siobhan? The last election, we lost about 5% of 17 to 24 year olds in the election. I get that 5% back, it's a different election.
Yeah.
Different electorate. And why would you say black women are there? Because black women deal with children. Black women are mothers. Mm. We're leaders. We're mentors. And we're in those organizations, those 36 and our local chapters that are actually programming in many of these spaces. Mm. Why not do our part as black women to ensure that civics, advocacy, voting is a part of that process?
Mm. Now, first off, I appreciate what it is that you're doing, and I salute you for that. A dear friend of ours, Dr. Camilla Westenberg, is yes. one such black woman who holds a very maternal space in our world.
Yes, indeed.
She is our teacher, and she is one of those individuals that approached us, you know, in an education type setting. And, you know, we've been riding that wave ever since. And she's also a member of the National Council of Negro Women. So, again, I salute those efforts. That is magnificent. I do want to go back just a bit. You mentioned that, you know, race is a social construct that was created and indeed cultivated to separate mm-hmm. folks in a society. And I want to talk about that a bit, because we've discussed it a bit on the show. But I think that this conversation certainly lends itself to developing that just a bit further. So my understanding of how race came about, because prior to that, it was just kind of national origin. Where are you from? Right. But race came about in terms of black and white, because there were no white people during biblical times, nor were there black people. Right. There was just people from this land or from that land or the other land. Well, race, as we think of it today, black, white, etc., came about 1500, 1600. So relative to the scale of human beings, it's a very modern invention. Mm-hmm. And it came about as a way to delineate a slave class of people. You know, there are people who always push back and say, well, black people had slaves in Africa and slavery has existed since blah, blah, blah. But in terms of the slave class combined with the chattel slavery element and enslavement in perpetuity, plus the gross kind of medical experiments and, you know, the permanent underclass sort of thing, all these things combined together created this sort of primordial ooze out of which the modern racism that we endure in this country sprung, you know. So, again, the slavery, once slaves were commodified by Europeans, all black people were slaves and all non-black people were not slaves. And so that's where the term black came from. Mm-hmm. And then the term white came to separate that, right? So this is kind of, we live in the legacy of that. And you mentioned how globally, you know, people interact with black people in a different way. Indeed, I know Q has a story that he shared with me before, and I'd love for you to mm-hmm. share if you can, about an experience you had in Spain that's very different from an experience we might have here in the U.S.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll tell the most brief version of that story. So, Siobhan, I used to live in Barcelona, Spain, and I was at dinner with a group of friends one night, and a basic conversation about where everyone was from started at the dinner table. You know, so where are you from, for 12 different people? And by the time it got to me, my answer was Detroit, Michigan. And I noticed a kind of confused look on everybody's face. So one of the other people tapped one of their friends on the shoulder, like, don't fret, I got this. No, bruv. Where are your parents from? I said, oh, that's easy. Georgia. Macon, Georgia, actually. And they looked even more confused, like, he doesn't get it. And one of the gentlemen at the table said, no, where are you from?
He rubbed his skin.
Rubbed the back of his hand. And it was a embarrassing, kind of hurtful moment. Because I realized all at once that the only person at the table that couldn't speak to where they were from Absolutely. Was me. Because as we've all said, there's no I'm black or I'm, you know, African American. It's your people come from somewhere, sir. And that's something that you need to know. But it's the first time I'd ever been asked that question in a setting where Detroit wasn't enough and where everyone right. else was identifying where their heritage, where their families came from. And I couldn't get back the five or six generations that would have taken me back to the continent, back to Africa, back to, you know, my actual lineage and tribe. So it was an unexpected experience, and it turned dinner into a very educational thing. But I'd never been more embarrassed as an adult than realizing that for the first time in my life that I did not know where I was from. And I had never even processed that question that way. So when you're talking about the social construct of race, it hit me in the face in a very, very real and unexpected way.
And we should probably, first of all, let me yield to this moment, because it also is interesting. When I do a lot of work and have done trainings in my career, we also other people that way in the United States. So your experience was as a Black man, right, which we would deem Black man, Black American man, who was unable to track lineage. For those who can track lineage in this country, we other them the same way, but differently. Where are you really from? I'm from Detroit. No, where's your family really from?
Yeah.
Detroit, right? No, but where are you really from? They can trace, I'm from China. I'm from, you know, Turkey. I'm from Russia. And it's so interesting how these experiences shape us differently, because in this country, the standard is you're an American, and the standard is you are classified by the social construct.
Mm-hmm.
You go somewhere else. And we listen, as far back as I can go, is a couple generations, because we don't have our history written. And for those that have been able to do it, I tell you, try to find it. Try to get it. Because it does change the way that you look at yourself when you see yourself. And that's the power behind all of this, which is why I think I'm so connected to this conversation, is that Black people's trek through the transatlantic slave trade was when we started to cut off some of our ability to track and trace and have that kind of power. So I think those are issues that we've got to really deal with and realize that what we're talking about now actually affects the way we vote, affects the way that we live in this country.
Wow. You know, there's something to, you know, this idea of voting, this concept of voting that is more important than I think people know. A lot of people know. And I certainly want to take some time discussing that, particularly in the context of this upcoming election, because there's a lot of reasons that people may not want to engage. And, you know, it's hard to push back against that. But also, I'm sure that, you know, and of course, we're going to want to get your thoughts on it, why it's perhaps more important than ever. And indeed, it's the only way to engage in a democracy. And if we ever want to tilt the tide back in our favor, that's the way that we do it. So we'll return with that.